turn to Hebrews chapter 13. We'll be looking at verses 1 through 6 this hour that deal with the subject of love and contentment. So let's read the verses first, starting at Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 1. Let love of the brethren continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. Remember the prisoners as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves are in the body. Marriage is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? We did an outline of chapter 13 last time, and we'll just breeze over it again since we've had it already. Remember, chapter 13 is a chapter that is the closing exhortation chapter of the book of Hebrews. It's taking all the doctrine that we've learned in this book, and what was the major doctrine of the book? That the new way, Jesus Christ, is superior to the Old Testament stuff. And now he's going to make some exhortations based on that doctrine. And the exhortation first is in the area of love, and in more specifically, love of the brethren. And that'll break down into two parts. We'll look at the exhortation in verse 1 and some specific applications of that in verse 2 through 4. Verse 5 and 6 talk about contentment. And again, that section breaks down into two parts. First, the exhortation in verse 5, and then the basis for our contentment in verse 6. We go from there to our relationship to leaders, and we'll look at that next hour to see what the believer's relationship to the leaders in his local body ought to be. We'll look at the attitudes towards doctrine in verse 8 and 9. We'll look at identification with Christ in 10 through 14. Worship in 15 and 16. And then we'll have the conclusion to the book of Hebrews in verse 18 through 25. So we're rapidly approaching the close of the book of Hebrews in chapter 13. So let's look now back at the details of that first section that deals with love of the brethren. And that's Hebrews chapter 13, verse 1 through 4. We start out at verse 1 with the exhortation. It says, let love of the brethren continue. Now that word, or that phrase, I should say, love of the brethren, is one word in Greek. And this is a Greek word that you all know. Yes, it's Philadelphia. Philadelphia, probably more in Greek, but that's the word. And it's a two-part word. The Adelphia part means from the same womb, literally from the same womb. It refers to brothers, sisters. The phil part, phileo, is the full word of it. It means affection or love. It's sometimes translated love. It's kind of a family type of love, a brother-sister type of love. So we have phil and adelphia, love of the brethren or affection towards the brethren. So we have affection towards each other. We have this family type love because we have the same origin. Spiritually speaking, we're all from the same womb. Now the author of Hebrews is going to use that word phil, the affection part or love part, three times in this context. Here he talks about love of the brethren, Philadelphia. And in verse 2, he says, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. Hospitality to strangers is also one word in Greek. It's philoxenia. So that phil again, the love of strangers is basically what it means. In verse 5, he says, make sure that your character is free from love of money. And that love of money, again, uses the phil. It's philargyros, love of money. So he's going to be talking about where our affections should be directed and where they shouldn't be in this context. There are three ideas that go with the word Philadelphia. The idea of kindness is associated with this word. The idea of sympathy and the idea of helpfulness. Remember chapter 12, look at chapter 12, verse 12 and 13. The idea of helpfulness is very clear over there when he says, therefore strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble. That's help yourself. And then he goes on to say, and make straight paths for your feet so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint. In other words, put your life straight so the person who's looking at you won't get off course. To be an example. And that's very helpful to be an example for other believers. Now these attitudes then, kindness, sympathy, helpfulness, love of the brethren, they should be true of all believers because we all have a common origin. I mean, spiritually, figuratively speaking, we're from the same spiritual womb. So we're all related in that sense. And we ought to love each other like brothers and sisters. Well, maybe not always like brothers and sisters, but normally, brothers and sisters. Now, if look at Romans 12. We'll see that these attitudes are expected of all believers. This is to be universal in the church. Love of the brethren. Romans chapter 12. And we'll just look at a few examples here of how often this subject is repeated in the New Testament. Love each other. And I take it it's repeated so much because we're so bad at doing it. Romans chapter 12 and verse 10, it says, be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. Same idea, in fact, the same word, brotherly love. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Now, as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. And love of the brethren, it's the same word again. 1 Peter 1:22. And we'll just look at that one and call it good, but you see this concept goes throughout the New Testament. A very important concept for believers. 1 Peter 1, verse 22. It says, since you have, in obedience to truth, purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. So again, it's stressed. Love each other. Now back to Hebrews chapter 13. And when we look at Hebrews 13:1, the words let and continue, it says, let love of the brethren continue. They kind of imply or suggest that there may have been a lapse here. Or maybe if it wasn't a lapse, there may have been a danger of a lapse. And that's why the author of Hebrews is encouraging them, let this continue. Don't slack off, in other words, as if maybe they were either slacking off or there was a danger of them slacking off. Now remember, the Hebrews were being persecuted at this time. They were being kicked out of the temple, and they weren't well liked among the Jews. Now they're possibly thinking about their own safety. You know, if I identify myself with this other Christian guy, especially if he's in jail, and we'll get down to that in verse 3, then I could get in trouble, so I'm not going to do it. So what the idea here is that we're to love one another no matter what the circumstances. Does it mean you'll get in trouble? So what? We're to love one another. It's throughout the New Testament. Don't think of yourself, think of the other person. It may cost something, but that doesn't matter, does it? The command is the command. Now we're going to have some specific applications of that love of the brethren. And the first one we have in verse 2, it says, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. So the first one is in regard to strangers. It's a specific application of love one another. Now, again, the words show hospitality to strangers translate one Greek word, and that's philoxenia. Again, the phil means affection, and xenos means stranger or alien in Greek. So a traveling stranger would be the idea. Now, in this context, the primary reference is to other believers who are traveling. And it's saying, don't forget to show hospitality to these guys. And we have to take a little bit of look at the historical context of this command. When this letter was written, the traveling believer, had two big problems. And the first one was that inns weren't all that common. There were inns, but they weren't all that common. Remember in Bethlehem, when Joseph and Mary came, they said there wasn't room at the inn, singular. So it implies that, and historically speaking, it wasn't a common thing. There were inns, they weren't very common. So it would be a matter of convenience to traveling believers to have a place to stay. I mean, obviously it's not right to let your brother or your sister sleep out in the cold, and we're all related because of the fact that we have a common origin. Now the second problem that traveling believers had at that time were that not only were inns not that common, but they were not that pleasant to believers. They were pretty much morally offensive to believers, in fact. You know, there weren't vice cops in the Roman Empire. The inns kind of were places where a believer probably wouldn't want to hang out. So those two problems led to the command, you know, don't forget to show hospitality to one another. Now, I want to stop and make a disclaimer here, because people can get really hopped up on this. An important note is that Christian charity is never, ever to be abused. And we're to be hospitable. But that doesn't mean someone can abuse our hospitality, because they're supposed to put up for us first. Well, we put them first. That's how it's supposed to work. Now, there's a book. It's called The Didache. And if you want to look this up in the dictionary, get this. It's spelled D-I-D-A-C-H-E. Didache. Don't ask me why they pronounce it that way. But that's what it's pronounced as, Didache. What it was a kind of a manual for Christians in the very early days. Before completed Bibles were common. They had this manual called the Didache. And F.F. Bruce, in his commentary on Ephesians, quoted a passage from the Didache that applies to this, not abusing Christian hospitality. It says, let every apostle who comes to you be received as the Lord, but he must not stay more than one day, or two if it is absolutely necessary. If he stays 3 days, he's a false prophet. And when an apostle leaves you, let him take nothing but a loaf until he reaches further lodging for the night. If he asks for money, he's a false prophet. So, very clear, even in early Christianity, that people were taking advantage of this. Oh, yeah, great. I'm going on the road. You know, this sounds good. But clearly, we're not to take advantage. Now, that's a non-biblical source. The Didache is a non-biblical source. I'll give you some examples in the Bible. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 5. Remember, 1 Timothy chapter 5 talks about the widow's list, and we won't get into that topic because we studied it in 1 Timothy, but I just want to point out how very careful Paul is when he talks about setting up this widow's list, that it isn't abused. Look down at verse 9. It says, a widow is to be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works, and if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. Wow, I'll bet there weren't too many widows on that list. But the idea here is simply this. Christian charity is not to be abused. And Paul was very clear about that. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. And we're all familiar with this passage. It's the passage that talks about Christian welfare program. Chapter 3 and verse 10. It says, for even when we were with you, we used to give you this order. If anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. Now remember, the problem down in Thessalonica was that they had been misinformed about prophecy, about the day of the Lord. They thought they were in the day of the Lord. They thought the Lord was returning soon. It was the end times. And they said, well, why should I work? I'm going to quit my job and wait for the Lord to return. Well, pretty soon the Lord didn't return and they ran out of money. So what did they do? They went to the other Christians. I need food. I need shelter. And Paul says, your response ought to be, okay, get a job. So, very important that we don't abuse Christian charity. Now, back to Hebrews chapter 13, I think we need to get both sides of that picture when we look at it. In Hebrews 13, the point is practice sensible benevolence. And that's up to us to decide what is sensible benevolence. Now, verse 2 gives us the reason for hospitality in the last part of the verse. And that is simply this. For by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. Now, this is probably a reference to Abraham. Y'all remember that story, don't you? Look back at Genesis 18. We'll just read the story. Probably, we're not sure it's a reference to Abraham because there were other examples of people being visited by angels. But Abraham was considered among the Jews to be the outstanding example of hospitality. So quite possibly is what it's alluding to up in Hebrews 13. And in verse 1 of Genesis 18, it says, "Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. When he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth." He sees strangers come up and he runs over to meet him and said, "My Lord, if now I have found favor in your sight, please do not pass your servant by. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet. Rest yourselves under the tree and I will bring a piece of bread that you may refresh yourselves. After that, you may go on since you have visited your servant." And they said, "So do as you have said." So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quickly, prepare three measures of fine flour. Knead it. Make bread cakes." Abraham also ran to the herd and took a tender, choice calf and gave it to the servant. And he hurried to prepare it. He took curds and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed it before them. And he was standing by them under the tree as they ate. So that's the story it's probably talking about back up in Hebrews chapter 13. And remember, they were angels that had appeared to Abraham. Now, I want to make a note here. I don't think the author of Hebrews is saying that we should expect visits from supernatural beings. He's saying this has happened in the past. I think what his point is here is that what he is saying is that sometimes guests might bring more than they take. So, especially if they're believers, you can learn from them. So there's a reason beyond hospitality, but it could be for our own benefit to be hospitable to strangers. And that's what the author of Hebrews is saying. You know what? It's not only good, it's beneficial to you too. So it's good for both of you. Now in verse 3, he applies this brotherly love principle of verse 1 to suffering believers. Verse 3 says, "Remember the prisoners, as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves also are in the body." Now this would apply to believers who were probably suffering or imprisoned because of their faith or because they're living in an environment that's hostile to Christians. And they were. They were being persecuted. They were living in an environment hostile to Christianity. Some were even imprisoned for it. Some were suffering for it. And the author of Hebrews says, as brothers and sisters, we should care for them. As he puts it, remember, and I take it, he doesn't just mean, oh yeah, I remember Joe, he's in jail. And then go on. It means do something about it. Go down and bring Joe in jail some food. You know, the Roman prison system wasn't great about feeding and taking care of prisoners. Now, in the past, the Hebrews had a good record. Remember in chapter 10 when we talked about this? Look back at chapter 10 in Hebrews in verse 32. We talked about the Hebrews were doing good in some areas and having problems in other areas. Well, this is one of the areas they were doing well at in verse 32. It says, "But remember the former days, when after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one." So they were doing very well in that area. Now the author of Hebrews in chapter 13 is saying, keep it up. Remember those prisoners. They're suffering because of their faith. Now remember, he goes on to say, and those who are ill-treated. And he gives a reason, since you yourselves are also in the body. So the principle is that as long as we are in the physical bodies, and I don't think he's talking about the body that's the church here. I think he's talking about physical bodies. He's saying as long as you're in a physical body, you are subject to suffering. Isn't that true? I'm getting some very emphatic nods here. Yes. As long as we're in physical bodies, we're subject to suffering. So remember that when someone else is suffering, because the tables could be turned. You're in a body just as frail and as weak as theirs. So that's the idea here. And the other idea is that, you know what? If one believer suffers, we all suffer. 1 Corinthians 12. Look at 1 Corinthians 12. 1 Corinthians 12 is talking about the spiritual gifts. And down in verse 26, Paul makes a statement. When he says, "And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it." He's using an illustration of the human body. He's saying the gifts are kind of like the members of the human body. There's some of them are hands, some of them are eyes, some of them are this, and some of them are that. And he's saying if one part of your body suffers, your whole body suffers. And that's the principle. And I'll use the illustration I always use, and you've probably heard it 10 times before, but it was back in Lincoln, and it was a Sunday morning, and I was up getting ready for church. I was doing what Ruth calls bumbling around. And she says that's what I do. And this morning I was bumbling around in the living room, and my foot ran into the living room chair, and I didn't have a shoe on. And it was one of those, it tore the toenail off, you know, it was a baddie. And, you know, most of the time, I go around not even cognizant of the fact I have a little toe. But you know what? All I thought of was my little toe for several days after that. And that's what Paul is saying here. You know what? If one member of our body suffers, the whole body suffers. We should be that attuned to each other, that if one of us suffers, it's like having a stubbed toe. Back to Hebrews 13 now. That's what he's telling these guys. He's saying, you know, remember the prisoners. Don't forget these guys. And again, I think he's implying do something about it, not just keep them in mind, but do something. Now, verse 4. Another application of love of the brethren, and that one is in marriage. Now what the author of Hebrews is doing here is what we call in the business world, especially in the computer world where I come from, a concept called drilling down. In other words, he starts with very general, and then he gets a little more specific and a little more specific. We do that in screens and computers. You start with a general view and you get more and more specific. That's what he's doing here. He started out love of the brethren. It's very general. It applies to all believers. And then he goes on to those who are suffering. That's a smaller group. And now he gets it right down to husband and wife relationship. Very specific group. So he says in verse 4, marriage is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. Now, I want to make a technical note on verse 4. In verse 4, the only verb in Greek in that sentence is the word judge. And if you have New American Standard, as I do, the words where it says marriage is to be held, or the old New American Standard says let marriage be held in honor. Are those words in italics, the to be held? Yeah, that's because they're not there in the Greek. That's why they put them in italics. And the marriage bed is to be undefiled. The is to be is not there either. And it says, for fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. And judge is the only verb in that sentence. So that first clause is what we call a nominal phrase. That means it doesn't have any verbs. And our translators have put in something for us. Obviously, it doesn't really make sense if you read it in Greek, if you're an English speaker, because it says marriage in honor among all. Well, we kind of have to fill that in. But there's two ways to fill it in, isn't there? And the King James Version took one way, the New American Standard Version took another. Now, King James has it as a simple declaration of fact. Debbie? Yep, marriage is honorable in all. That's simply a statement of fact. Marriage is honorable. But the New American Standard has translated it, let marriage be held in honor. That's an exhortation. You see the difference? And it's all based on the interpreter. Now, when we have a situation like this, the best thing to do is look at the context. And I think the context here goes for the New American Standard way, that it's an exhortation, because of the warning in the last part of the verse. It says in verse 4, marriage is to be held in honor among all, or hold it in honor, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. Why? For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. So he's given the reason why he's given this exhortation. So I think the exhortation is probably the correct way to interpret that verse. It says, if you keep your marriage right, this won't happen to you, is the idea. Now, the idea of judgment here is the idea of discipline. Now, we get scared when we see that word, oh, God will judge, that means I'm going to hell. No, judge is a very broad term. It means to come to a conclusion, to hold an opinion, to judge a person to be guilty and liable to punishment. And that's what he's talking about here. He's talking about discipline. You know, there are things the believer can do that will beget God's discipline program, his education program. He'll teach you about things, and if you're stubborn, the teaching isn't very pleasant sometimes. But God is the perfect Father. Remember, we saw that in the book of Hebrews. So he will teach you. Now, there are two things he mentions here that will defile a marriage. First, before the wedding, that's fornication. And after the wedding, that's adultery. So he says, if you keep your marriage right, these things won't happen. Now that brings us to the subject of contentment. And we're not going to have time to finish that this hour. So we'll have to do a little catch up next hour when we start at verse 5. Father, thank you for your word, which is living and powerful. In Christ's name, amen.